cell phones. If you do want to tweet about the event, it's hashtag VABookFest. Thank you so much for the sponsor of this event, which is the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. As you probably know, the festival is free of charge, but we always thank contributions, and there are many ways of doing that, including going online to the festival website. Also, really important to fill out that yellow form that was given to you at the door. This is a way of surveying the popularity and also the population coming to the book festival, really important for future plans. Also very important, we will be sharing the books that our three authors are going to be talking about, and they'll be signing books afterwards in the back of the room. So please support the festival and National Geographic Books with your purchases. So back to National Geographic, let me just read you our new mission, a little bit of our new mission statement. You don't want to hear the whole thing. Furthering knowledge and understanding of our world has been the core purpose of National Geographic for 131 years. And now, as of yesterday, we are committed to going deeper, pushing boundaries, going further for our consumers, and reaching millions of people around the world in 172 countries and 43 languages every month as we do. National Geographic Partners return 27% of our proceeds to the nonprofit National Geographic Society to fund work in our areas, in the areas of science, exploration, conservation, and education. So every book, every National Geographic book that you purchase is actually contributing to the cause of the National Geographic Society. Today we have three representatives of three gorgeous, big, beautiful books. Let me just quickly introduce them to you, and then I'm going to have each of them speak to you. Then we'll have some questions from the audience. Mark Thiessen, who's going to be our first speaker, has been a photographer with National Geographic since 1990, and he directs the National Geographic in-house photo studio. He's widely published in National Geographic Magazine and National Geographic Traveler. Since 1996, his personal photography specialty has been wildland firefighters, and he even became a certified firefighter in order to move on to the front lines of this phenomenon and goes to the fires and works with the firefighters and photographs every summer. His cover story on firefighters earned first place recognition from Pictures of the Year International. He lives in Washington, D.C. Catherine Herbert Howell, our second author, has written more than a dozen books and contributed to dozens of others, including the very first edition of National Geographic Field Guide to the Birds of North America, published 35 years ago and now a mainstay of birders in its seventh edition. She's also written chapters in our Illustrated Guides to Nature and our Illustrated Guide to Wildlife. Her chapters became pocket guides. She wrote a beautiful book on the role of plants in history called Flora Mirabilis. And she wrote all three editions of an illustrated reference titled Peoples of the World. Catherine lives in Arlington, Virginia. And finally, James Treffel, who's come back to the University of Virginia. He was a faculty member here many years ago. He is now the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of Physics at George Mason University, internationally recognized as an expert in making complex scientific ideas comprehensible. He's the author of a number of books on science for the general public, many of which we at National Geographic have published, including most recently The Story of Innovation, the first and second edition of Space Atlas, and one that's currently underway that he and I are working on together, tentatively titled Science Wonders, for which Jim is actually doing the writing on behalf of Neil deGrasse Tyson, who will be working with us as well on that book. So all of these books, curiously enough, these books were selected without my realizing that every single one of these was published on the same day, October 23rd of last fall. It's a key day. It's one of the last two. Our books always publish on a Tuesday. That's one of the last Tuesdays in October, preparing for the big Christmas season. So every single one of these books came out on the same day, and you can imagine that 9 months before, all of the editors are scrambling like mad. So I will let Mark begin the conversation.
Thank you, Susan. Can you hear me back there? Yep. Hear me? Okay, great. I'm thrilled to be with you today to speak to you about spectacle, rare and astonishing photographs. This is a book published in the tradition of great National Geographic photo books, coffee table photo books. It contains over 200 photographs, and each one is a spectacular moment in time. And as a photographer, I can tell you that it's rare when the light, the composition, and the moment all line up to produce a photograph that you didn't think you could take. You're like, my gosh, did I take that? You're taking your pictures, and then you look at your back of your camera, and you go, wow, did I do that? And there's a word for it. It's called chimping, because you sit there and go, ooh, 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 ooh. That's true. So this book is divided up into four, it's really a word, it's from the digital age. So this book is divided up into four chapters. So chaos takes you to Iceland, where lightning bolts splinter through the evening sky as ash billowing from an erupting volcano. The lead picture in Surprise is another eruption. It's the time, this time it's spring flowers in the grasslands of the Carrizo Plain National Monument in San Luis Obispo, California. Behold the beauty chapter, as seen through the eyes of our photographers. And in this case, the photographers are Diane Cook and Len Jensel, who photographed fireworks during a celebration at a chateau in Mainsey, France. And finally, awe gets you wet as you swim with a free diver through a school of thousands of fish off the island of Tonga. And of course, I have a few pictures in this book, and I wanted to go through a few of them and kind of give you a backstory behind some of them. Does anyone know who that this is? A flower? This is a water balloon the moment it's breaking. So there's no camera shutter that could freeze that at that moment. So instead, we used high-speed strobe. So we turn off all the lights in the room, we put a strobe behind the water balloon, it's dangling there from a fishing line, and you can see the pointy stick I'm poking it with. And then we have, the key point is a sound trigger that hears that water balloon breaking and sets off the flash. And the flash duration is about 20,000th of a second. So here's a quick little video that I made of us doing this in our photo studio in Washington, D.C. And I'll just kind of narrate this as it goes. There's the flash on the right. The sound trigger's down below. There's my pointy stick. And there's the camera. And it's connected to this computer. And now I'm going to point the stick, and the flash is going to go off. And now we're going to go back over to the computer, and you will see the picture. And this one, you can see a little bit of the balloon still in there. So, of course, the speed, we can play with the speed of light, and we can move that sound trigger back a few inches and then get that moment where that balloon is completely gone, but the water still is suspended. So, yeah, that's kind of fun. That's kind of fun. We have fun at work. We get wet a lot. So this is, anyone know what this is? These are methane bubbles in absolutely clear ice in Alaska. So as the permafrost melts, methane becomes a problem. And there, these new lakes form that because the permafrost melts and there's no oxygen in the water, the vegetation turns into methane. So this was for a story I did on methane. And when the lakes freeze in the fall, they start at the top and then work their way down. The ice forms at the top, of course, of the water, and then some bubbles come up. And then the ice forms around them. And then the ice keeps forming down. And then a low pressure system will go over. And then more bubbles will form, and it just get this stair step case. It's kind of like a chandelier effect of an absolutely clear ice. Here's a few others that I found on this lake. Absolutely beautiful, aren't they? Methane's a greenhouse gas 25 times worse than CO2, but it makes really great formations in the ice. And so then this methane, of course, is flammable. So I'm going to show you a video that I shot for our story. And this is a video as I was shooting it. And the scientist was going around popping these methane bubbles. And someone was holding a match. And you'll see what happens. So this pocket of methane is burning under the ice. And sometimes this would happen. We weren't really sure what was going to happen. And sometimes this would happen.
Whoa!
That's so much fun. My assistant is a smoke jumper in Alaska. And he's lived in Fairbanks. This is outside Fairbanks. For years. And he never knew this. So he would spend his winters now. So there's one of the pictures that appeared in the magazine. So here's another picture of mine that's in the book. And Susan mentioned kind of shooting forest fires is my personal passion, and I went through fire school so I could be safe. This situation, I want to explain a little bit about. This is near Sealy Lake, Montana, and I'm deep in with a fire crew, and we're doing a backfire. So a backfire is where you start at a river or a road, and you burn out all the unburned vegetation between that and the main flaming front. And the main flaming front sucks in the fire, and that way it burns up all the vegetation, so you have a wider fire break. So this was a situation where the fire, the wind shifted, and the embers went up through the smoke column down into the green side, and we had fire on both sides of us. We were the furthest ones in, and this is a picture I took before that one. This is the division supervisor, the guy who's like the field general in charge of everybody on the fire. And he is evacuating all his people out. The smoke column has shifted over top of us, and it's dropping embers that you can't see in the daytime down into the green side, which is on our left. And that white dot is the sun. That much smoke has blocked it out. And this is the view immediately to my right. So you can see how the wind has shifted, and embers are coming over, so he evacuated everybody out. Here's a picture that's not in the book, but it's these embers are the reasons that these houses burned down. This is in the San Bernardino Mountains in Southern California. This is a house at the very early stages of burning down. Strong Santa Ana winds. So this is what went on in Paradise in California recently, is just like what went on here. Embers land. When you go back and you see all these homes and all that's left is chimneys, you think that it was just nuked with a tsunami of fire, but that's not what happens. It's these embers the size of a pencil eraser that come flying through the air, and they land on things like these dry pine needles on this deck. And they're hot and dry winds, 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, and then the houses catch on fire. There's nobody around because they've all been evacuated. This is the same view 24 hours later. What do you see on the trees? There's leaves. It's supposed to be a forest fire. What's going on here? So these houses set each other on fire. Because when a house burns, it sends off all these embers. And you can see this tree here is scorched on one side from the house burning down. Right, so here it is again. I'll give you a little before and after. So I just wanted to leave you with one other thing. I've got a story coming up in the May issue of the magazine on Alaska smoke jumpers. I spent 2 summers up there following them around the vast and remote state of Alaska, putting out fires, photographing them, putting out fires in the middle of nowhere. And the guy wore a GoPro for me as he jumped into the fire. So next up is Catherine Howell, who will talk to you about the splendor of birds.
Hello, thank you for coming out on a rainy day. It's great to see such a great crowd here. October of 2017, I was asked if I would like to help pull together a book that showcases all of the coverage that National Geographic has given to birds over its history, which goes back to 1888. The photography aspects of it had already started to be uncovered by the photographic image people, the people who archive them and tend them. They were starting to get an idea of how the book would take shape, but there was really no editorial outline because no one had ever taken this subject and dissected it from all of the amazing and very, very numerous images that National Geographic holds in its image collections. But at the time, you might expect for a photographic book that there would be a general idea like, okay, we're going to do a photo book, it's going to be about birds, use template B and throw the pictures in and write the captions and write some essays, and then that's how you do it. But that's not how you do it, even in a picture book. Each one is created anew from the subject matter. The subject matter kind of leads the look of the book, and that's what we found out when we were doing birds. Now, I had access to everything that was published. Thank God they digitized the whole collection of National Geographic. I did not have to thumb through magazines and look through indexes and things like that. It was all online. We'd still be working on it now, I think, if that weren't the case. But that made it immensely easier. And as I did the research of how the Society had treated birds in its publications, and primarily the National Geographic magazine, working closely with the photo people, we got a narrative of how all this works and what the key concerns were, the key methods of presentation, and how all this tracked over the years, of course, based on things like the photographic constraints of the era, which in the beginning were very constrained because of the methods of photography, the cumbersomeness of photographing things, the equipment, which was heavy, the glass plates, which were heavy and had to be carefully carried wherever the photographer went. Journalistic objectives, which were very much of their time. In the beginning, people who were involved with wildlife were often hunters, and when they wanted to study a certain animal, the easiest way was to go find one, shoot one, bring it back, look at it, and just, you know, decide how it works. And that's how many of the early bird artists work. They shot to study. And that was a method that was perfectly accepted then. People were still shooting to, you know, put food on the table. And it wasn't as much of a pure sport as it is now. So National Geographic started in 1888. It took them a while to get a regular editor, but that happened in the 1890s. The full-time editor was Gilbert H. Grosvenor, and that name would remain in the National Geographic family, as a family, you know, for more than 100 years. He was brought in and immediately faced some resistance because he was a champion of early photography. He was an amateur photographer himself. He thought that the magazine, which was just print, no illustrations, would be very greatly enhanced by some illustrations. And believe it or not, he received a lot of pushback for that. And there were board members and other officials who thought that that would just demean the academic integrity of the high-minded, you know, research that they were disseminating to the public. But a very literate public who didn't mind reading treatises instead of articles as we do now. But so Gilbert Grosvenor came on and he championed photography throughout. He introduced color photography in the early methods by hand tinting and then by autochromes. And he was the one who really started the ball rolling as for the illustrated articles that we now take for granted and have become the trademark of National Geographic. So the first image in the National Geographic image collection is this almost picture postcard from Hesse in Germany, and it shows children in native dress and geese. And as far as I can tell, this is the first time that birds appeared in the National Geographic archive. I don't believe it was published, and it even predates the founding of the Society, so they probably got it, you know, after they were started making their image collection. The book, The Splendor of Birds, is divided into four chapters, and they each cover a time frame. This one is from the founding, chapter one is from the founding in 1888 to right up to World War II, 1939. The book encompasses both photography and representational art, which went along in tandem with photography. National Geographic always used artists to depict things that couldn't readily be photographed, to educate, to bring scenes together that wouldn't occur, that occurred in past times, or bring animals together in a perfectly organized ecosystem so people could see how all the parts work, knowing that a photographer wouldn't walk out and find everything that they wanted to depict in one, you know, in one day. So this is a photograph of from Africa. It's a piece of art from Luis Agassiz Fuertes, who was one of the early artists for National Geographic. He was Cornell trained, and he was considered the successor of John James Audubon in this country. These are African whooping cranes. Now this looks very familiar, and you might think it could come out of the March of the Penguins, but it's not. It came out in 1912. It was shot on location by Frank Hurley, who was a photographer who, among other things, documented the expedition of Ernest Shackleton. He captured still images and film photography as well, moving pictures. And his images were shared worldwide and created something that has never abated, the penguin mania that continues to this day. He readily recognized that penguins were a very charismatic kind of bird, and they never disappoint. And unfortunately, they're found in the forest reaches where not many people care to, have the opportunity to see them in real life. Among the earlier grabs for this time period was this photograph of a hummingbird who's taking a foray into an artificial blossom. This is by Louise Burt Baines. She was a pioneer in early 20th century photography. And again, the hummingbird would be a group of birds that continue to fascinate because of the maneuverability of their flight, their metabolisms, and every other thing, including just their sheer beauty that you could imagine. But here's an early capture of a hummingbird who I'm sure quickly figured out that flower was not going to yield any nectar and moved on. Among the species that we are so familiar with now because of things like nature specials and David Attenborough, the bowerbirds of New Guinea and Australia. This is a 19th century drawing from John and Elizabeth Gould. They show the bowers as they used to be, which was a collection of natural objects, maybe a shiny pebble patio, and then a collection of shells and animal bones. The male would build the bower out of the vegetation, furnish it with all these different objects that he found in his wanderings, and then entertain a female as a prospective mate. She walked around the place, inspected it. He did a little show for her, and then she thought about it and either walked away and said, good luck to you, and moved on to the next guy, or she decided that he would make a good mate, and they would go and mate, and then she would go build her nest, and her nest has nothing to do with the structure. It was just a nest, but this is the way the bowerbirds wooed, and it was, when exploration was in its heyday, these were the kinds of things that really grabbed people and that people really wanted to see. You jump forward, this is 1916, you jump forward almost 100 years. This is a photo by Tim Lehman, again in New Guinea, and he has captured the bowerbird, the same species, but his bower is quite different. Most of it is man-made objects. You can see some pebbles by his feet, but this bird has accumulated the trash of our society and whatever maybe came floating up onto beaches or wherever he grabbed things. You can see, and I don't have my pointer with me, there's a soldier, a plastic soldier, there's a plastic elephant, there's aluminum, there's flashing, there's rope. And it looks a whole lot messier than that beautiful illustration before it. And I don't know if that's a trend with bowerbirds, that as they've added junk to their bowers, they don't arrange it, you know, as precisely as they used to. I'm sure somewhere, if it hasn't happened, there will be a cell phone in a bowerbird's bower. We haven't seen it yet. People have documented a prosthetic glass eye that was found, who knows where, in a bowerbird bower. But this is to show how 100 years, you know, makes a difference, and also these animals that were so exotic to people of the late 19th and early 20th centuries are way more familiar to us. We've all seen them. We know the bowerbirds and the birds of paradise. We know how they dance. We've seen them do their things on nature specials. But back in the day, it was a very, very intriguing thing to learn, indeed. But now this is this photo is by Arthur Allen, and it is the first and maybe the last capture of the ivory-billed woodpecker, a mated pair. They're changing shifts at the nest. And this was photographed in 1937, and Arthur Allen would illustrate many, many articles for National Geographic. He did a lot of things with bird blinds and set up shots where he'd put vegetation that certain birds liked and get his camera camouflaged and maybe hide himself and take setup shots, but he also went into the, he went out and did his own explorations and expeditions and captured some iconic photos. And although it's black and white and it's kind of hard to see, when you stop to think about this magnificent bird, it was a huge bird. You think a pileated woodpecker is big, but this is even bigger. And it's something we will never see. There have been apocryphal sightings, but nothing has ever panned out, and I think most bird experts have said we need to put that one to rest. We're just not going to see the ivory-billed woodpecker again. The next chapter starts with World War II and goes to 1969. World War II changed things immediately. It restricted the photography that people could do. It brought it inward. It brought it into the United States. It brought it into the war effort. So a lot of the articles, instead of being about exotic places, became about domestic birds, domestic poultry, the poultry production that supported our war effort, the birds and other animals that were conscripted into the armed services to help the war effort. But first, just at the cusp, there was a twin brothers from Washington, D.C. They went to Western High School. In their spare time, they captured hawks and falcons, and they trained them in Rock Creek Park and took pictures. And still teenagers, they took their portfolio of pictures into National Geographic and said, hey, we have these pictures of birds, and we can get birds to do all kinds of things that we want them to do. And the powers that be were very captivated by these brothers. They were called John and Frank Craighead, and they were identical twins. They went on to get PhDs in wildlife conservation, and they spent the rest of their careers leading expeditions, leading studies, and working for the cause of conservation. But as older teenagers, this was their passion, and they were easily able to convince the photography people and the editorial people at National Geographic that theirs was a worthy cause to support. it up? Okay. These are pigeons at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, who are part of the Army Pigeon Service. And the after hours, the soldiers would work with the pigeons and entertain them and be entertained and generally just hang out with them. Of course, homing pigeons were a big part of the war effort here and as well as in Europe. Part of the photography, the look of National Geographic at that time became the red shirt theme and or a red bird theme or a person wearing red with a red bird. This is a photograph by Louis Martin, who was instrumental at that time for his adoption of Kodachrome, which changed the look of photography. He also worked extensively with Jacques Cousteau, and he developed many of the underwater photographic techniques that Cousteau used in his explorations and his documentaries. But the pretty woman with the parrot became a meme of the magazine at the time, and anything red, if you go flip through old National Geographic, you'll see someone with a red polo shirt or a red windbreaker, or it was a pretty stock look at the time. This is back to New Guinea. This is art, obviously. It's a bird paradise, a display. Now here this shows you something that art can do that photographs can't. Can't accomplish, and that is an artist can portray a bird, and magically these birds decide to sit on bare limbs. No leaves in the way. That's something a photographer does not have at their disposal, because you're shooting through trees and leaves, especially birds like these who live in forests. But birds of paradise, as the bowerbirds before them, were something that always remained an object of fascination for the people who followed this in National Geographic. This is a photo by Hugo von Lawick. It was captured tangentially in some coverage they did in that he and his wife Jane Goodall, then wife Jane Goodall, obtained in Egypt. And it's one of the first documented uses of a tool by a bird. This Egyptian vulture is using a rock to break open an ostrich egg. Moving into the 70s and toward the end of the 20th century, of course, photography is changing. There's more of a concept of photojournalism. There's greater environmental awareness. 1970 was a watershed for the environmental movement. Legislation passed. And then it changed the way people covered birds in the magazine. It made it more of the birds telling their own story in their own habitat, less interaction with people, and more of just going out and seeing and documenting behavior, and also the increasing devastation of wildlife in various parts of the world. This is a photo by Dieter and Mary Plaga, and it shows a great egret on a crocodile. You'd think that was a very precarious place for it to be, but I'm sure it has worked out exactly where it can stand and not be captured by the crocodile if it swung its head around, but it's using the croc's back as a fishing platform. In 1983, the National Geographic took a huge step and decided to publish a field guide to the birds of North America. It was an illustrated guide, not a photographic guide, and it was one of the biggest undertakings that, for the time, that they have ever done. Of course, they've done 7 editions of this now, but the first edition that I was involved with was, to call it epic doesn't do it justice, but it involved 13 artists who painted 200 plates under supervision of the staff, of experts in the world of ornithology, and every detail of every bird on every plate was checked against skins of birds that belong in the Smithsonian collection. It was a huge undertaking, and done by an army, and but it worked, and it was immediately upon a publication, it was accepted by the people that mattered, the ornithologists and the birders who use guides to identify birds. National Geographic never looked back at that point, and they just keep publishing bird books. And now it's less of a monumental task to put it out. But this is by John O'Neill, who was one of the original 13 artists of the field guide. This illustrates the change in the time between film photography and digital photography. Bill Kurtzinger, who's one of the premier underwater photographers, was constrained by the fact that he was working with rolls of film that had 36 frames, and he could not change his film underwater. And he had to take what he had, shoot it, cross his fingers, hope that it came out okay. Sometimes he worked with someone on the surface who would reload cameras for him, and he would swim up and get those. But he didn't know what he got until after the film was processed and looked at. As opposed to Paul Nicklin working in 2012, also in Antarctica, he had digital equipment. He knew immediately what was going on. He could check his camera and see what he got. And you can see, when you have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do this, how digital photography has changed very dramatically the kinds of things that photographers do. Sometimes excellent photographs are captured tangentially when something else is being studied or shot for an article. This is by Annie Griffiths, and it shows American white pelicans on a salt marsh channel in the Mississippi Delta, and I always call this the commuting penguins. I have no idea where they're going, but they seem to have a purpose, and it's just one of the images that really struck me when I was working through them. The final chapter coincides with the digital age and takes us up to last year, which was the International Year of the Bird, which was one of the reasons why this book was published when it was. Of course, by 2000, digital photography is really the standard, and this photograph of a trumpeter swan by Robbie George illustrates that. Now this is a photograph in Antarctica of chinstrap penguins on a glacier. It was shot by Maria Stenzel. Maria Stenzel is a National Geographic photographer. She was also a UVA grad. She started at National Geographic the same year that I did. She started out, I believe, as an illustrations assistant, and she crafted this amazing career for herself in photography. And when I think to myself what it takes to capture an image like that, and all, you have to go to the ends of the earth, and you're in these conditions, and to get something that beautiful as a reward for your hard work. This is a serendipitous photo taken from an aerial shot by Robert Haas. These are flamingos who serendipitously made a flamingo image somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico. I'm sure, you know, finding that image totally unexpected was quite a revelation. You must have seen this. It's one of the most reproduced images the National Geographic ever did. It's a gentoo penguin with a backpack that is not a camera, that is not an early critter cam, that has equipment that monitors the bird's vital signs, and he has a radio antenna, and his vital signs are captured remotely by people, you know, kind of keeping track of his comings and goings. But this little guy was very famous for many years and still is. This is the critter cam, and this is an emperor penguin named Rodney. He's got a kind of middle-aged model of the critter cam. This was in 2007. The critter cam was developed in the 1980s by a man called Greg Marshall in cooperation with National Geographic. And of course, now the camera has been in various iterations has been deployed on at least 50 different species on land and sea, and we just come now to expect it, to get these amazing images of animals that they themselves take. This is a very early bird selfie. It was created by George Shiras, who had a huge impact. He was a former congressman from 1903 to 1905, and he became interested in photography, and he was able to use remote setups to have birds take their own photos by tripwires and so forth. These are black and turkey vultures in Florida who are feasting on some food that's been left out for them. Here is the modern day equivalent, captured remotely by Charlie Hamilton James. He had cameras set up, this is in Grand Teton, and when he would run in every so often, every few weeks, and grab the memory card from the camera and look on his laptop to see what he had. This is one of the images that he found, the money shot for all the hundreds and hundreds of hours that his camera was obtaining images in this national park. In the last 15, 20 years, the photographer Joel Sartori has moved into portraiture of birds, especially those that are in danger of vanishing. He sometimes brings birds into a studio, but he often goes to their facilities where they live, zoos or research stations or whatever, and creates kind of studio-like conditions in which to photograph the birds. These are spectacled eiders, kind of duck, and this particular photograph really speaks to me as the diversity in the bird world, and you ask yourself why, you know, what are the way the bird plumages end up just being so incredibly decorative and purposeful, but at the same time beautiful, and I personally, you know, find it awe-inspiring to see things in such incredible detail. And finally, there's a shot created in a lab to better understand how hummingbirds feed, and this is by Anand Varma, who works a lot with scientists to help them realize the kinds of experiments that they want to capture photographically. And this has a glass vessel, and the hummingbird inserts its tongue to feed from the nectar, and you notice that the tongue is forked, which was a tremendous finding, being able to see it this way and how it operates. So we've brought photography and the images of birds up through the present, and also carried forth the mission of education and understanding and stewardship, which has been a hallmark of National Geographic coverage of birds as well as other kinds of wildlife and ecosystems. And I'm very happy now to turn this over to Jim Treffel.
Getting up in a sliding chair is not so easy. You're at a festival of the book, and I'm sure that you've heard other authors talking as the festival has gone on. And what I thought we might do, what might be kind of fun right now, is for me to walk you through what happens when you do a National Geographic book. Because it turns out that this is very different from the conventional book. Now, every book starts with an idea. And one of the questions authors often get asked is, where do you get your ideas? And, you know, conversation, I saw a movie, I had a dream. They're all over the place. For the National Geographic, it's very simple. I get the idea for the book when Susan calls me and asks me if I want to write it. And I understand that that's because they have done all kinds of market research. To me, it's a black box, but it makes it very simple. The next step is you got to decide what's going to be in the book. Now, normally what you do is you get your idea, you develop it, you write up an outline, maybe do some sample writing, send it around, you or your agent send it around the publishers. With National Geographic, that process gets reversed. You do the outline after you sign the contract, which is very nice for authors, for obvious reasons. The next thing you have to do is who are you writing for? Well, who's your intended audience? And in a normal book, I mean, I can tell you who my intended audience is. I think I'm writing a book about some area of science, and the person who I imagine reading it is someone who's very intelligent, has a highly technical job, you know, a banker or a financial consultant or works in the biomedical field or something like that, but doesn't know much about physics and astronomy, but would like to learn. And my job is to present the ideas to that person. Now, when I'm writing a National Geographic book, I have a very different audience in mind. I have an audience of grandparents. Not grandparents who read the book, but they'll buy it for their grandkids. And that's why it's got to get out in October. And the idea is that, you know, kids are naturally curious about the external world. And if you want to encourage that in your child, or you want to initiate that in your grandchild, you can do much worse than using National Geographic books to do it. So all of this, you know, is what happens before the first word of the text goes down on a piece of paper. Incidentally, for prospective authors in the room, it really helps to have a friend as your editor. Susan and I go way back, more years than either of us wants to remember, when she was a graduate student here studying Victorian literature, and I was a physics professor, and we did a reading course, didn't we, on Victorian science, romantics, whoever. I was more interested in the science, and you were more interested in the literature, but that's the way it's supposed to be.
I thought it was the other way around.
The perfect partnership. The question then becomes, why are you writing the book? What is the purpose of the writing? And when you start thinking about how a book is organized, ever since the invention of the alphabet, you've presented knowledge or ideas in a linear way. You start at the beginning, you go on to the end, and then you stop. And there's this linear theme that runs through every book, and certainly nonfiction books, that gets you to the end where you want to be. With National Geographic books, there's something different. We've already heard some really good descriptions of this, but there's a second line of reasoning, or a second line of thought. In addition to the text, which is conventional, there are the pictures. And the idea you aim for is that somebody who looks at only the pictures and the caption should come away with pretty much the same kind of knowledge as somebody who reads the text. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And sometimes there's even a third stream, where you're putting in sidebars and little bits and pieces here and there, and somebody who reads that ought to come away with pretty much the same kind of knowledge. So as a writer, this poses certain technical problems. For example, this book that Susan mentioned that I'm doing with Neil deGrasse Tyson, we've set it up so it's organized around important questions. Why is there something instead of nothing? What is life? These kinds of things. And each of these is a chapter in the book. And then there are, by our count, 10 sections in each chapter in which you look at different aspects of the question you're asking. So what about life, for example? One of the chapters is, you know, how do you define a living thing? What is it? And, you know, I personally wind up with that famous quote from Justice Potter Stewart, in a case involving pornography, you know, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it, and you go on from there. So when you wind up, one of the reasons that the astronomy books are so beautifully illustrated is almost all these photographs come from NASA. They're public domain photographs, and one of the reasons I like to do National Geographic books is because in the end you get this beautiful product, that you have your standard book, your standard ideas, you've got the ideas you want to get across to the reader, but in the meantime, you've got something that a five-year-old can open and look at the pictures and just like it. And I think in the end, that's what makes National Geographic books different from others. Thank you. Now we're going to go to questions.
Great. And we have a few minutes. I'd love to open up the floor for questions. And if you don't have any, I do. Yeah.